Welcome to the Social Network Show. How do you feel about social technology in this connected, networked world we live in? Your host of the Social Network Show, Dr. J, interviews entertaining and informative guests to tackle the most pressing digital issues of interest to business professionals and nonprofit leaders, to parents and educators, and to those wondering where all this is taking us. And now your host, experimental psychologist, Dr. Jane Karwoski.
Welcome back to the Social Network Show. We are talking again to Spider Graham, and he has a special guest with him today. After you listen to this podcast, you can visit our website, thesocialnetworkshow.com, and check out his guest's headshot. Jim Meshkowska is one of those guys who was a delight at 8 years old and has stayed delightful in the same impish way up to this very day. He is co-founder and chief strategic officer of Media Darwin, where he helps clients develop an awesome business communication strategy. He's a mediologist who has spent the last 20 years living, breathing, and thinking about how to use media to move people to action, from strategy, planning, and buying to measurement, data tech, and operations. He's got it covered. That's one of the very cool things we can do here at Social Network Show, bring you a half an hour or so of consultation with national, even worldwide experts at absolutely no cost to you. Now, Spider, I kind of shortchanged you on your introduction. You are the author of Taking Down Goliath and the CEO of TrainingCraft, LLC. Anything else you'd like to add about yourself?
You know what? I've been in this business probably way too long, along with Jim. Jim and I have been contemporaries for a long time. And actually, Jim and I became friends because he was writing for ClickZ, among other things, and as was I. So we kind of were just co-correspondents and guys who were just really trying to put our finger on the pulse of what was going on in digital media back, I think before it was called digital media. This would have been late 90s. And so it's such a pleasure to have Jim with us today because apart from being a veteran, I think he has such a unique perspective. And Jim, obviously I want you to talk about this, but so much of what we've been doing for the last 20 years is really about solving problems. I love the way you summarize it because our goal is really to be able to help our customers do a better job of communicating. So tell us a little bit about why you started Media Darwin and what problems you were trying to solve, and I imagine we'll get a little insight into the process from that.
Well, one of the reasons why I've started Media Darwin, aside from the fact that anyone who's spent a great deal of time in very large organizations eventually finds a home in that large organization and wants to stay there and do the kinds of things that they feel they can do best in that sort of environment. If you don't do that, then you end up striking out on your own, such as you've done, and I'm sure many of your listeners have done, and so that's what I ended up doing. And one of the reasons is because my feeling was that the way that larger media planning and buying organizations work is they focus a lot on what I call puzzle-only problems. They wanted to collect as much data as possible, put it all together in a package that they hoped was representative of reality, and then activate whatever kind of communication plan, media plan they could against that, and essentially let it ride. And I felt that what a lot of that process did was abdicate a certain amount of responsibility on everyone's part so that they could say, well, gee, that didn't work. I guess it was because of the numbers weren't right. And I felt that there was another side to the kinds of problems that marketing needed to solve. And because I'm a bit of more of a philosopher type anyway, I felt that what Media Darwin could do was take a more philosophical approach, I guess, for one, and also, as the name suggests, somewhat of an evolutionary approach as well, taking a look at things as the iterative changes over time in order to improve.
Something you said made me think about the whole adage of no one ever got fired for buying television because it was tried and true. But I think, and I know we've talked about this in the past, and maybe people should have been fired for buying television because it was also really hard to measure and really hard to quantify. And it sounds to me like you're actually kind of bypassing a lot of the guesswork and coming up with real reasons why you should take specific actions, not just because it's what the other boys and girls are doing.
I do try to do that. Now, to be fair, it doesn't work that way because a large part of my work is what I call consultative, which is I call it commercial communicative action consulting, which is if you're going to pay money to get your value proposition somewhere else that it wouldn't be on its own naturally, then I'm going to get be responsible for it in some one way or another. And we would call that in the old days, you know, just good old-fashioned media planning or buying. And a lot of the ways that has happened over time is here's a budget given to you by a client. Client says, I want 30% in TV, I want 20% in print, though they don't really say that anymore. I want, you know, some X percent in digital, I want some percent in direct mail, and let's go. And nobody thinks about why that should happen. And the why is the other half of the kinds of problems that need to be solved in marketing. So if there are puzzle problems, which are data-driven, there are also mystery problems, which are interpretive and require a certain amount of experience and human intelligence. And what that answers are those certain amounts of whys. Certain things should happen. So why are you going to spend in television? Doesn't mean it's a bad idea. Spending in TV could be just fine. It's still one of the most popular media. In fact, it is the most popular medium, depending on who it is that you're trying to work and reach.
Jim, when you mentioned the puzzle versus the mystery questions or problems, can you give us a brief example of each from clients that you've had, different problems they brought to you, and how you decided one was a mystery problem, one was a puzzle problem?
Sure. I'll start by generalizing a little bit, which is the puzzle problem is where if I have enough of the pieces together, I can get the picture. The mystery problem tends to lean more towards motive. So if on the one hand, I am looking at actions and I'm trying to determine what kinds of actions the target audience takes, that would be the puzzle part of that of trying to solve that problem. The mystery part of solving that problem is the why. So if one of my clients had been Dole Fresh Vegetables, we did a lot of puzzle work, which was, okay, who are the target audiences? Where do they live? How is it that they're spending their time? Those are all puzzles. And in fact, most of what we do in advertising and marketing are solving puzzles. We don't spend a lot of time, however, solving the mysteries. But with Dole Fresh Vegetables, one of the mysteries we tried to solve was, why is it that someone is going to be interested in product or service? Why is it that they're going to, for Dole Fresh Vegetables, the product was, you know, pre-washed lettuces, right? So you open the bag and if you wanted to, you could just dump salad dressing in it, shake it up and down, and eat it with a fork out of the sack. Now, of course, that wasn't the image that they were trying to give off, but it would have been that simple. So why is it that people would want this sort of product? And it takes a certain, it still requires research and it still requires data, but what you're trying to get at is motive, and motive is a little bit more sublime. And the motives that we had uncovered for this particular client were health and convenience. You know, one of the things that one tries to accomplish with branding is an irrational response. You know, why do I want to pay more for something that I could pay less for something? And the reasons have to be irrational reasons. I need a limbic response, not a rational response. J.P. Morgan once said that a man does things for two reasons, a good reason and the real reason. And the mystery solution part is trying to get the real reason. And so the real reason can still be got at through the collection of data. It's just what kind of data and how do you go about getting it? You know, and then what do you do with it once you've got it and how can you turn it in such a way so that you're looking at it in a slightly reticulated form that can create, you know, what we used to call art or inspiration in coming up with what the activation plan might be. That's where those two things meet. And I realize that the mystery side of things sounds a little bit squishy, but if you ever sit in a strategy session, most of those end up falling towards, you know, there's a lot of squishiness that gets discussed.
Right. Well, that makes a lot of sense. To be irrational is really rational.
Right. Well, you know, a long time ago, I'd written a series of articles on neuromarketing because for a while that was an enthusiasm. There had been a front line on public television, I want to say back in the early aughts, and it was called the Persuaders. And it was really quite insightful and very interesting. And, you know, some of the listeners might remember this. You guys might remember this. And one of the people they talked to was someone who talked about, you know, you're looking at the brain and looking at neurology and using, you know, MRIs to see how brains lit up and worked up. And while it never really took off as a method for trying to, you know, activate advertising, because let's face it, you know, how many of your audiences can you go ahead and put in a gigantic magnetic donut and look at what their brains are doing so that you can decide what sort of advertising to show? I mean, it's a ridiculously expensive and arduous enterprise. But what you do learn is that, hey, there are three parts of the brain, and people respond to the things that appeal to the older parts best and first. And so, you know, the old part is the R-complex, or the reptilian brain, and the sort of oldish medium part is the, you know, the limbic system, and the new part is the part that we would call rational, which so far I've found doesn't really rational. It doesn't provide rationale. It simply post facto rationalizes whenever we do things.
Well, that is cause for deep thought. We'll ponder that. Thank you for listening, and there is more to come. In the next half, Spider-Graham and Jim Maszkowskis will go on to talk more about Media Darwin. Spider, what can we expect in the next half?
Well, you know, one of the things that Jim brings to the table that's really unique is he's approaching a different methodology, and the whole idea of he's really doing what he can to listen to the marketplace and identify the things that are going to make the biggest difference. It's not just a matter of following the fold and buying media. It's about the reasons behind why we buy media, because, you know, at the end of the day, it's about the reasons behind why consumers do what they do, and that's what he has his finger on the pulse of.
Super. This is Dr. J, and you're listening to The Social Network Show.
Questions? Comments? Email us at questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com. Now, back to The Social Network Show.
Welcome back to The Social Network Show, where you are hearing from Spider Graham and Jim Maszkowskis of Media Darwin. Spider, what else do we want to find out from Jim while he's with us today?
Well, I think Jim brings just an interesting perspective. I mean, one of the things that we see in our industry all the time, of course, is that there are people who will position themselves as media strategists, and a lot of it is about problem solving. And Jim does all that, but Jim also has in my experience in working with him and knowing him as a friend over the years, is he has a much deeper dive into looking at the human psyche, if that's the right way to put it. And identifying what it is that makes people do the things that a marketer may want them to do. And, you know, so much of it comes back to the fundamentals, Jim, and we probably all talked about this at one point or another. But, you know, we cringe an awful lot because there's a certain amount of marketing out there which is cringeworthy. But so much of it really seems to kind of back away from the idea that they're even, A, talking to human beings in the first place, or, B, getting their attention the right way so they can start a meaningful conversation. So could you spend a few minutes kind of talking about your approach to how you get the conversation started on behalf of your clients and help them to understand the importance of not just throwing stuff in front of a consumer and saying, here you go, but instead trying to engage them in a meaningful way?
Well, you brought up the right point, which is that, you know, so much of marketing doesn't even seem as if it's actually geared towards talking to human beings. Now, I have a host of theories as to why that is, some of which are not very palatable, very popular with a lot of people with marketing today, because everything is so technologically driven and data driven, and there is a sense that, you know, all we need is better engineering and we'll solve all of our problems. And so I guess I'll do a kind of a story that I told someone from AppNexus once, which was that, you know, data alone doesn't answer enough of the problems in order to get at the root of the why. I mean, we mentioned, you know, earlier that the why is a really important part for me, and how do I get at the why? Now, again, what's interesting is there's research that you can do to help find out what why is, but the example that I gave to the person at AppNexus who, in response to my saying that, you know, all of human behavior can't be rendered into machine-readable form, his was, well, soon it will be. I said, okay, let's pretend that that's true. Let's then pretend that there's two different reasons for somebody to get married. One reason is for money, and the other reason is for love. So I'd get married for love or for money. Now, in terms of monitoring my activities and collecting data in order to make decisions about how to reach me, you're going to see a person regardless of which motive, do essentially the same thing. They're going to go about the whole planning process the same way that anyone would. But somewhere along the line, the reason somebody is doing something is going to matter. And it's going to matter when you say what you're going to say to them in order to persuade them to choose you over someone else. So what's interesting is that a lot of my approach ends up ultimately having more bearing on the rails of the communication plan than it does on the specific media that is selected. Now, that isn't to say that it doesn't have some bearing on the specific media that is selected, but what matters almost more through that exercise is just what it is that you're going to say. And so while I'm not a creative person, part of my strategy work lends itself to informing what it is that you're going to actually say to whomever it is. Because if the motive for getting married is money, it's a much different thing that that individual will respond to than if the motive of them getting married is for love. Even though what they're doing is the same thing, the actions they're taking are the same. But what's missing, of course, is why. And that goes back to the whole puzzles versus mystery solution. And so the approach that I like to take whenever it comes to any advertiser or any product category or any of that is to always pretend that it's never been advertised before so that we can clear the table of any sort of prejudices, expectations, or action only rather than motive also metrics for what the communication plan should consist of.
You know, to that point, I absolutely agree with that, because the action is going to be the same, but the motivation behind it is going to be different. Is it really just a matter of looking at marrying for love versus marrying for money, or there are other reasons that can be thrown in or at least look for to determine why people take specific actions? And once again, you know, getting back to the whole idea that we're not all the same person, and we don't necessarily all do the same thing for the same reasons.
Right. I mean, we have to find the balance between, and it's a crazy little space, and I'm afraid if I get too much into it, I'll offend somebody if I say too much about the pitfalls of big data. But at the same time, I will of course advocate it at every turn as being the sort of work cloud for the comets that shoot through and strike the earth and get the job done. But so somewhere between we're all God's little snowflakes, and we all kind of march off into the meat grinder like that clip from The Wall. There's something kind of between that, which is there are clusters of activities that seem to be the same. But one of the challenges with trying to use clusters of activities that seem to be the same, which are all based on a birds of a feather flock together principle, which doesn't sound very techno-savvy, and so instead we use profiles and look alike and act alike and all that sort of thing. It's essentially all saying the same thing, which is the birds of a feather do seem to flock together, is that there are six basic human responses and emotions to things, two of which are affirmative response, the rest of which are not. So when you think about what is data, data is that which is countable, typically, the datum. And what most of data-driven decision-making relies on is whatever is countable. But there are lots and lots of non-actions that are just as important. And so we have to try to figure out, and I haven't necessarily figured this out aside through what is essentially an extensive interview process, is looking for what I call human behavior dark matter, or marketing dark matter, which is, there's the stuff that people do. It tends to be an affirmative response, data. But what is it that they're not doing and why that is? The only way to get at that is either to ask, and then, of course, you're going to get, not kind of messy responses because, as we've learned, people aren't very, very good at survey data or giving, real honest answers. They usually tell you what you want to hear, not what they really think. And so you can watch what they do. But right now, the most exciting space, and I'm going to hate myself for saying this because at every turn I'm usually fighting with people who think that this space is going to be end-all be-all, but I'm concerned that they might be right, and that is the social strain. And what I have started to do is to Frankenstein certain social listening and predictive analysis tools and put them together, and at least for my business, which is trying to make media decisions, do that. Essentially, take the raw social stream, sift it, try to find patterns in it, and then use that to inform media planning decisions, because that is currently the closest that we seem to be able to get at, you know, looking without influencing, you know, that sort of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle of means of perception altering the perceived. The social stream seems to be a good place for it. Now, it's not perfect, and there are plenty of instances where it isn't going to necessarily be the case because of the way herds work and the way that people use social media sometimes to self-brand and do fluffing. And, you know, I would like to say that nobody, few people are posting pictures of the shitty meal that they had. Ooh, excuse me, I didn't mean to swear. You know, or the crappy birthday party they went to, or the horrible vacation they went on. So you're not, you know, again, it's not the whole picture, but a lot of times it is more of an unadulterated view of what is motivating people and what's going on the inside than it would be if you were to have them sit down at the table and give them a 15-page diary to fill out.
Sure.
So that's what I started doing, is actually using social stream data to inform comms planning and media planning decisions.
Well, when you mention social stream, I assume you're talking about all the social media posts and so on that a person or people put out, but are you talking about taking that from a certain segment of the population or individuals? How do you actually grasp that data?
So one of the things about big data, and if you want to talk about, you know, I always like to shock people with the notion that there are varying sizes of infinity. People are like, what? Infinity is as big as it is. I was like, okay, how about whole numbers? Yeah, that's a big infinity. All right, how about irrational numbers? Oh, and macro, that's a bigger infinity. The social stream is like a bigger infinity, if you will, of big data. So there's like big data and there's big data, and that would be the social stream. And, but the thing is, and I have a friend who runs a fund where all they do is invest in like social media technologies and research and media platforms and those kinds of things. And he gave an interesting speech the other day. He said, you know, let's pretend that all human nodes on Earth are in the social stream. In theory, you'd have a near infinite amount of data and you would always get the right answer from it. However, every answer would be the right answer. And the problem is because you're not shaping it with the hypothesis. So You have to shape it with some amount of hypothesis, which, of course, it's really funny because the way that you do that is to revert to the old school ways that we've been doing media planning and buying since we were able to determine that somebody was either 25, they were in the box of 25 to 34 or 35 to 44. And you'd revert back to that. And so you'd go back to, all right, I have to put rails around this data. So I have to make some assumptions about who it is I think that I'm after, create a hypothesis, and then test that hypothesis and stress it out against the data. It's the only, so while the social stream, we could say, is kind of nigh infinite. And it's actually changing its shape rather quickly right now. So like the most accessible parts of the social stream are becoming actually older, and the younger, and older in terms of the population that's in it, younger parts of the population are not in it and are harder to get at. And so there are tools that people are developing, and there's a lot of, you know, interest in that space, which is consists more of what has been termed, not terribly successfully, the visual web. And, you know, you're all the picture-oriented stuff and the stuff that doesn't seem to really live very long, like your Snapchats and those kinds of things. But that being said, there's still a big chunk out there that you can get with Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and Google Plus, and you know, I mean, I just named all the very obvious ones, but there's you know, a dozen more that contribute to the data set. But yeah, I mean, you have to draw a circle around something conceptually, and then put it, you know, stress it out and put it against the data that you're looking for.
You are certainly showing us why you are a specialist in this and launching us into deep thought here. Thank you so much. It's been an honor to have you both on the show. I want to thank you, Jim, and also Spider for joining us, and Spider for bringing us these fascinating individuals. So appreciate that very much.
Absolutely. So thanks for joining us, Jim. Really appreciate it.
Well, thanks. I apologize for being so scattered. As you can tell, I had a cortado right before the call. I'm all hopped up on hot milk and espresso.
We'll blame it on that. No, I think you were very, very thought-provoking. So thank you all for listening to our listeners, and appreciate your support and your interest. And I hope that we are providing the type of content that is really helpful to you. Please let us know via questions@thesocialnetworkstation.com. And Spider, thanks again for joining us for the Spider Graham series on the Social Network Show.
Welcome, Dr. J. My pleasure.
Please have fun, everyone, and be safe at the same time, online and off, until we welcome you here again.
You've been listening to The Social Network Show, the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media. Listen to archived shows and follow us on Twitter. The views expressed on The Social Network Show are those of the hosts and guests and may not be the views of Social Network Intermedia. The Social Network Show is produced by Social Network Intermedia, copyright 2012.